This episode of the Unstoppable Recording Machine Podcast is brought to you by Solid State Logic. SSL is a manufacturer of high-end mixing consoles and recording studio software. For over 49 years, SSL's products have been at the heart of thousands of the most respected, timeless recordings. Solid State Logic, thank you for listening. And now your host, A.L. Levy.
All right, well, welcome to the Unstoppable Recording Machine Podcast. With me is none other than John Douglas and the one and only Jens Bogren. Welcome, guys. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, it's a pleasure getting to talk to awesome people. So, Jens, you have been on this podcast before, so if anybody listening wants more Jens Bogren after this, just type him into the search. We did an episode about 2 years ago. So with that said, I know that a lot has happened for you in the past 2 years because I've kind of been in touch with you on and off and about scheduling like Nail the Mix and everything. And I know that there's been periods where you've just gone dormant working for like 9 months straight. So was that one record? Like, did you spend 9 months on one record?
Absolutely not.
Okay.
I guess the most life-changing thing that happened the last 2 years was my third kid, actually.
Oh, congratulations.
Congrats. But I've been working, on various projects. But the last year has been quite production intense. But the next year is actually going to be spent mostly doing mixing and mastering. So that feels good.
So, and is that by design? Like you want to take a break from producing?
Yeah, it is. This last year nearly killed me. So for me, it's like vacation doing only mixing and mastering compared to full productions. So,
well, you did the production on the new Dimmu Borgir, right?
Yeah.
Which sounds phenomenal.
Thank you.
I've heard that their records are very, very intense to make.
Well, they are intense people, so yeah. It's but yeah, I've also done some other challenging stuff, like the latest Amorphis album, which I don't know, great guys to work with, but a very challenging record in terms of arrangements and stuff. So definitely.
What's challenging about it?
Well, I guess that the vision for the album sort of grew a little bit along the way, and we had a lot of people involved. You know, you get an idea like, hey, we need a saxophone here, or what about a choir part here? And all these small things, they add up to, you know, becoming pretty pretty massive arrangements in the end. And at the same time as you're recording and trying to, you know, nail good vocal takes, you have to sync with some choir arranger down in Israel on this particular album. Singing lines over WhatsApp to to help out on certain things. And yeah, it's just been massive. And then the wife calls, it's like, yeah, we have a chaos here. One kid just threw up and you need to come home. It's like, my God. So it was a challenging year for various reasons.
So you had multiple records that were not just your standard metal band setup, like multiple records with just expanded arrangements coupled with real life.
Yeah, exactly. And I seem to be, you know, poor luck because I always get to work with those albums that seem to be
I was about to say that sounds kind of like, I mean, not sounds like, I know that you're known for this, but seems like these bands with super heavy arrangements, dense, not heavy. I don't want people to misunderstand why I said heavy, but you get to do records with super dense arrangements. Do you listen to music like that? Like, did you intend for it to be that way? Or has it just kind of evolved to that in terms of the clients you're getting?
I don't think that I've had so much to say about that. You know, it's the chain reaction of events that has led up to the bands that I'm working with, I suppose. You know, I do have sort of my own personal musical background is definitely of the more challenging type. So I guess I feel at home doing those sort of albums, but it's nothing that I've asked for. Actually, quite the opposite. Every day that I put up a mix with 250 channels plus, I wish that I was doing punk albums instead, you know.
Well, I mean, maybe it didn't help that the way that I guess the wider world found out about you was an Opeth record. That's when I first heard about you, was an Opeth record, and those always have a million things on them. You know, so between that and watching those videos of Devin Townsend, and I know what goes into his records, just seems to be like when you think of crazy arrangement metal, you think of your name. Please don't hate me for that.
No, I hate myself.
When you're working on stuff like that, take, for example, the Dimmu record, I was watching like one of the behind-the-scenes kind of teaser studio videos, and I think one of the guitarists was mentioning like just kind of like the experience of sitting in the back of the room and watching the drum tracking sessions. And I guess he seemed like he didn't really have a total idea of what you were listening for. Like, he'd be like, you know, the first take was great, and then they did like 10 more after that, and I had no idea why. But for a complex record like that, is that something that you can describe, or is that something you have trouble kind of communicating to people involved with the project? Is like, no, it has to be a certain way because XYZ.
That depends, really. I mean, some people are pretty sensitive about that, like, why are we doing more takes, etc. But I think that quite often the musicians, at least the drummer in this case, is his own biggest critic, you know? So, and sometimes it's more about them. I was happy with the fifth, you know, after five takes, and he wanted to try two more.
Right.
And sometimes you need to limit the musicians in that regard, because you know that if you spend more energy here, you're gonna lose down the line instead. So now, usually I don't have a problem, you know, motivating or having to explain why we're doing another take or whatever. I get to, you know, people call me all kind of fascist names in the end, but usually I get away with it.
Is that a big thing you've had to learn how to do, working with these huge records? I mean, again, huge in terms of arrangement. They're also really well-known bands, but huge in terms of arrangement. Do you have to pace yourself, or do you have to think about it in a time management sort of way to make sure that you and the band have the energy for it and also the time to be able to do everything that needs to be done?
Absolutely. I would say that that's probably the most important task for a producer, that you need to, you have this budget to relate to, and you have this time frame that could be, you know, stretched to a certain amount perhaps. But how do you spend that time in the best possible way for, you know, the best outcome of the album? It's probably not to spend six more takes on a certain guitar take. It can be, but that making that sort of help me with the word assessment, the value or
opportunity cost. In business we say opportunity cost.
It's a very nice word you have there.
Thank you. it's just how much does the time cost you? To do, you know?
Has your team expanded over the last couple of years since you were last on the podcast? Have you added more people to the Fascination Street team?
2 years ago, I don't think so. I have an assistant called Linus Corneliusson, who's since then has become a full-time employed. He used to be his own, but now he's my slave completely, so to speak.
Awesome.
And we also have another full-time guy from Portugal who's doing like a long-term internship. It's probably going to be like, I haven't told him, but 1.5, 2 years possibly that he's going to be here. So he's our new slave.
He doesn't know how long it's going to be?
No, exactly.
So he'll find out. I haven't
given him the key to the the chains yet. So.
I'm just kind of interested in that whole team building aspect to it, because looking on the website, you have 7 people listed, I think, and they're all, well, some of them are in, you know, a completely different studio, or they're working out of their own home studio, or working out of another city. So you really only interact with, how many people do you, from that 7 people, do you interact with on a project, say like the demo record?
Well, I mean, if it's something that I produce myself, then my right hand is my assistant, which would be Linus, who deals with editing and stuff. I used to do all that myself, but I have realized that it's not a smart move. So
yeah,
I've trained him over the years, and he's probably better than I am these days in terms of drum editing and some, you know, vocal editing and whatever needs to be done. So that's very important for my sanity and to, you know, to keep happiness, to feel happy about the project all the time. And also for the project to move forward, because the people in those bands, they are away from their homes and their families. And the more efficient I can do things without compromising the quality, the better everything is going to be for everyone. So that's really important, my assistant. And then I usually have a drum tech. It's not listed on the website, but that's also a pretty important part. Then my mastering engineer, Tony Lindgren. Usually I don't do mastering myself for my own productions. You will see that is a lie if you check the credits, but that's at least what I tried to have him master, to get a fresh ear on things. So I would say 3-4 people usually, and like on this latest Amorphis album, we also had one of those 7 people. Is also a songwriter, so he co-wrote one of the songs with Amorphis, which Annika from X Gathering was singing. Yeah, I guess on and off 3-4, possibly 5 people on a production.
When did you start delegating like that? Like, when did you stop being a one-man show?
When I got married.
Oh, you got married a while ago too.
Yeah, 11 years, a few days ago.
Yeah.
Well, I think that I just realized that the mental stress of doing everything yourself, because I'm a very picky guy, and I work on these huge albums, and it would take too long to complete, and you don't have that time. You know, you have a release schedule, the bands are touring, they need to write the songs, they need to go into the studio, and they have a master delivery date before they even have any songs written, and you need to make the album in this period of time. That's why I have decided to let go everything that I feel that I can let go and still be able to gain from it on a mental health level, and also the end result.
Yeah, like speaking of the website, just looking around on there, I was looking at the form to get you guys to master a record or a song, and I was just really impressed by how slick it is and how like well put together everything is, and it takes care of all the information that you would need to know about the studio, but also it's just like a 4-step process to submit your song to be mastered, and you'll get it back in a week or two from either you or Tony. And that, going along with the whole organization of having 4 or 5 people working on a record, how involved do you get in managing kind of the big picture of everything, or taking care of that kind of website stuff, or the more just studio business type stuff? Or do you have someone who is kind of overseeing that?
Unfortunately, I'm doing all that myself, at least when it comes to the vision. And then I have obviously a web designer, you know, helping out and whatever. But it's hard. I have been trying. I think I reached out to Joe Sturgis actually once about trying to help with this sort of, you know, he was offering this sort of marketing, you know, help and whatnot. So yeah, I have to do all that myself, and a few late nights every few months I sit with all the papers, you know, trying to organize and get it to the accountant, and yeah, unfortunately I have to do everything.
How about like session organization and just like general communication between one party to another, or like making sure that everybody has the right versions of files, or like is that something that you I know some people are more anal about it than others as far as like file naming and you know, this has to go here. I did notice when we were getting the Nail the Mix files from you, you have your own like file delivery FTP server or something like that, which not a lot of people have, but you know, that's nice to have just like a dedicated portal for bands to be able to get their material from you. Yeah. I'm not sure if there's a question there, but
no. But I'm not sure if we're that anal, but you know, there's a lot, many years experience, you know, what it takes, and obviously my assistants are helping me prepping the sessions before a mix, for example, and then there are certain ways, or at least rough guidelines, how I want things labeled and organized, and if they fuck it up, you know, they get to see the UI. And,
the other side, side of Jen.
And yeah, so I guess, you know, we're just working so close together for so long, so it just works out, I suppose.
Do you have like file naming protocols and things like that, just to make life easier? And if so, did you invent it?
I don't think so. I mean, I do have sort of a protocol because I always seem to want to label things roughly the same way. And I guess that's invented. It's sort of a Swenglish version, you know, where I make some English and Swedish words. Yeah, I don't like when I cannot see the names on a track, for example, in Pro Tools, which is the software that I work with. So we try to shorten things and, you know, get a good overview. But I'm not Daniel Bergstrand. I think he's pretty anal about those things. But I probably a little less, a little more chaos.
Hello, Daniel, if you're listening, we love you. But
absolutely.
I was thinking of something that you said to me in an email. So when we were deciding on which way to go for Nail the Mix, and by the way, I could not be happier with having Heir Apparent on there.
It's, yeah, I was so excited amazing. To see that.
So thank you for being able to help that happen. But so, you know, we talked about lots of different possibilities for a while. And one thing that you said that I'd like to talk about some, because I'm curious, is you said that you think that the new demo, even though it would probably never happen anyways, is just probably too difficult for the scope of Nail the Mix. And I've known previous people who have also mixed their records or those types of records, and they say it's the most difficult thing they've ever had to mix. So I would like to talk about what you found difficult about it, and what the challenge is for you on a record like that, that has the orchestra and multiple different types of vocals and more and more and more and more.
Yeah, when it comes to demo specifically, there are two things I would say that are that makes it quite difficult, and it's very specific vocal effects all the time, orchestrated by Stian or Shagrath or whatever you would like to call him. And those things are not super easily, you know, recreated. And of course, those could be printed in the context of Nail the Mix. And on this particular album, I shouldn't take away the magic for people listening to it, but it's a very complex orchestral situation on the album, and it's not a good thing. It's because the band really wanted to use some of their pre-production stuff, and I really wanted to use another orchestral arranger. So there's a very unholy combination of those, like, going on the album, and that makes it really messy, the whole session. So that's why it would be difficult. I mean, I do a lot of other stuff that I think is just as difficult as Dimmu, you know, like... even Rotting Christ or Septic Flesh or something like that. Mm-hmm. Septic Flesh even more so, since they have like a full real orchestra with both full brass section and full string section and choir section and everything. So many people would probably not even be able to load those sessions on their systems.
What's what do you find to be the most difficult thing about the orchestra with blazing death metal or black metal?
Well, the difficulty lies in the laws of physics. The more stuff you add, the more, you know, ambience or reverb or natural reverb that you have, the more, you know, frequencies and space gets stolen in the mix. So what you thought was a killer drum sound when you mix the drums, you know, 2 hours later, when you have put in not only a full guitar section and four, you know, quad track guitars and lead guitars and screaming vocals and a big choir, but you also have a full string section and everything, there's nothing left. You just have this small, the tiniest drums ever heard on an album going on somewhere, and then you, what should I do? And then you go back, and then the band says, no, you need to raise the orchestra, and I cannot hear the flute, and you know, it just goes on. I think that it takes a lot of experience how to mix to be able to get a metal sound and a full orchestra. And sometimes it's not that, you know, difficult. It doesn't matter that much if it's not the fattest metal band on the planet because the orchestra is so important, but other bands really require that basic heft, you know, no compromise band, but still the orchestra should be really loud. And that is just laws of physics that it creates some, it takes some skill to get it working.
Do you have to do a ton of automation? I'm just wondering because I remember back in the day when the Death Cult Armageddon mix came out, that was like my favorite mix for a long time. You know, the classic demo that I think Fredrik Nordström mixed it. And the thing that I noticed about it, even back then, was that there had to be a ton of automation because if you go part by part, in one part, the guitars will be loud, and then they'll be quiet, and they'll be loud again. It's the same with everything else. Like, the volumes vary wildly from section to section, but there's always something in front keeping your attention, always. So it seems like the mix, the automation had to be, keep on altering to keep something as the main focus, while and then a hierarchy after that of all the other instruments and where they fall into place in that hierarchy. So, like, it's really interesting. You follow one instrument through an entire song and just listen to the volume levels it's at. It's, you know, it seems schizophrenic or something, but or just say the kick drum or something. You just pick an instrument and listen from start to finish. It's a very, very interesting thing. So I'm just wondering, when you do these types of mixes, is it automation out the ass for you?
Of course. I mean, you have to automate a lot. I guess I would try to mix so it doesn't feel like the kick is going in and out, or the guitars are going in and out. And sometimes you just need to trick the brain that something is louder than it really is by ramping it a little bit, you know, that it, when it enters, it has a certain volume, and then you can slightly decrease it and, you know, work with that type of things for things to take attention without completely messing things up, I suppose. But yeah, automation.
I didn't mean, by the way, that on that record that things disappear or sound like too small suddenly or whatever. We're talking like small changes that, yeah, like I can hear a dB change or something, mm-hmm, that maybe your casual listener wouldn't be able to hear. But yeah, so, you know, like you drop something a dB to make room for something else kind of stuff. I don't mean like suddenly you're listening and the guitars go down 12 dB or something, something insane like that. So you are doing constant detailed automation. So, and just to reiterate what you said, so that you can't tell that things are really getting louder or softer, but to make room for all the new elements that are coming in.
Yeah, I mean, it completely depends on the song as well. Usually these type of songs with Dimmu and also with Opeth, the different parts are pretty different from each other as well. So I guess it will come natural that you need to either automate a lot or even, you know, duplicate and start over with a new type of setting for, let's say, if the vocals suddenly go down in range a lot, but it's supposed to be the same voice, then you might need a new track for that to make that work. And the same goes with violins, for example. If there are violins playing in a certain riff and there are heavy guitars and drums, and suddenly that figure keeps on playing, but the guitars and drums stops, then the violins will sound really thin, and you need to automate also EQ and yeah, whatever needs to be done, basically. And usually there's a lot of stuff.
Would you like loop a section and just kind of mix that section in isolation and then kind of move on to the next session? Or do you kind of listen to, say, a couple sections at a time? Or is there a kind of general process that you go through for that?
I mean, the general process is that I usually mix the most difficult and heavy parts first, which typically is the chorus, if there is such a thing in the song you work on. So that whenever that happens, it should sound the best. So not like the first verse sounds great and then everything falls into, you know, like a house of cards when the chorus comes. So that's the standard thing for me, to try to keep work on the most dense part, make that really work, and then you take the other parts from there and do whatever automation or new tracks that you need to do. But the mix should be optimized when it's mostly difficult, so to speak.
So lots of mixers prefer to mix non-attended from the clients. I know me personally, I always prefer that. But, you know, I first remember seeing that video, Devin Townsend coming to you for that mix. And I almost feel like, how could you mix a record like that without having someone like him there? And so I'm just wondering, on these super complicated records where obviously the artist has a big opinion and a big vision on what it should be like, and it's not just rhythm guitars and leads and, you know, it's something huge. What do you prefer?
I mean, I definitely prefer to mix unattended for the better part of the mix. But it does depend. That the Devin Townsend album that I mixed, called Deconstruction, that is the most complex album that I've ever mixed.
And it's one of my favorite records, just by the way.
That's cool. And that was the whole idea. Devin's vision for that album was that this needs to sound like the most complex album ever done. Okay, thank you, I said. for that album, it was a must to have him there, because you wouldn't believe the amount of stuff he put there, and there was no logic to what should be in front or not. You know, that would even though if I could have a artistic vision of that and thinking that, yeah, this is great, you know, if he would have a completely different vision, that would be equally fine. And after all, it's his album. So for that album, I think I spent like a week just getting all the basics up. And then we spent another, I don't know how much time, but it took a long time and basically worked everything in, you know, according to his vision. And we had some fights and, you know, hugs, kisses, etc. In the end, I think we made something that was that he was really happy with, at least. I haven't listened to it since then, so I don't remember. Too much trauma.
Do you ever listen to your own work afterwards?
I mean, it has to go a certain period of time. When you have released all the little hang-ups you had about it, then I suppose it's fine. I remember one time I might have said this in the previous podcast, so it might be weird if you listen to that one as well. But I was going in my car and I heard this like snare sound on some song. It's like, my God, this is really good snare sound. And then I turn it up, it's like, oh, that was me. That was old Catatonia album that I did. And so that's a good thing then, if you can listen back and you don't remember anything, you just can sort of, you know, enjoy it as regular listener. But
so that's something similar happened to me once. I was on tour and there was something playing over the house PA while we were loading in, and I was just like, that riff is cool. Just like, what is that? It sounds so familiar. Like, what is that riff? And just, you know, leave the venue, pick up some gear, come back in. It's still playing. It's like, this sounds so familiar. Yeah, it turns out it's a band I recorded. I totally forgot. I didn't even remember what the name was.
Yeah. Happens a lot.
I'm sure.
One of the other records, one of the bands that I've kind of been following for a while, and you've worked on their last four records, I believe, is Leprous. And it's kind of a different, I guess, changing directions from the more, I mean, their mixes sound fairly dense, but it's not a deconstruction or anything like that. What has that relationship between you and the band been like? And just, I guess, thinking about having repeat clients and getting sort of a trust built up between you and the client, to where, you know, they were recording some of the guitars and bass on their own, I believe, and you've had different roles between either tracking drums and then mixing or just mixing. So what's that been like?
Well, with Leprous, I suppose they were probably around 10 years old when I mixed their first album.
Wow.
I don't know, but they were actually the live band for Ishan. Mm-hmm.
Those guys, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, they were young when they came out.
Really young, yeah.
Yeah, I remember them. Okay.
They just stand out to me as an example of a band that's been, you know, started young and has been really consistent in quality, and, you know, they found a sound that they really like with you, apparently, and it's just been on an upward trajectory ever since then.
Yeah, absolutely. I think they've been searching a lot for their sound, though. You know, for every album, they've had a little bit different visions, and they changed the drummer into this really crazy guy for the last two albums, I think. And for the latest album, they wanted to step up a little bit, and they actually, I didn't record drums there. There was David Castillo, one of the seven guys on the website, in our Stockholm facility, that recorded, most everything, I think, on that album. And then I mixed it. And they wanted to, you know, go a little bit more organic or whatever. But so I think they're definitely searching around a little bit for what they want. But they've grown older and they've been touring a lot, and they have, you know, drawn inspiration from other bands on the road or whatever they listen to. And, I guess I've just been happy being able to help them along the way, because I love the band and the guys are great. So,
well, you know, on that topic of trust, I don't read Blabbermouth. very often, but for some reason I was at Blabbermouth the other day and Amorphis were on there and they said that you could sum up the reason they came back to you in one word, trust. That was the headline. Actually, that stood out to me. Which was very nice of them to say, but how have you thought about how you go about establishing that kind of trust with artists? Is it just something that happens naturally? Or, I mean, it's no way that artists just trusted you out the gate when you were starting. You had to get to that point, right?
Yeah, I guess these days it's, I would say that it's fairly easy for me. It's it seems like people, you know, when they come to me, they
know
already,
the deal.
Yeah, they're already confident that they're gonna get, you know, something they probably like, or you know, they can reference to something else I did or whatever, and then we might have a discussion about what could be unique for them or whatever. But it used to be much more difficult, you know, in the early days of my career, where especially it seems like these days I work more and more with a little more mature people, perhaps. But when I was younger, I guess I also was working more with the debuts and you know, young bands, and usually young bands are really nervous, you know, about everything, mm-hmm. About their own instrument, and you know, and they throw different references, you know, and we need to have that snare sound from this album, and we want, you know, and it just becomes a really messy type of production. So that way, it's better these days when people approach me and they might have some visions, and then they want me to do my thing, sort of, and then hopefully that's, you know, something they like, or we adjust, or whatever, and something hopefully good comes out of it. So, yeah, trust is pretty easy, I must say, for us who's been working for a while in the business, I guess.
Well, there's no way you'd be working this long without having established it, I think.
Oh, there's always new clients to rip off.
For those clients who do end up recording some amount of their record themselves, if not all of it, do you give them, like, how much instruction ahead of time would you give? If they say, we're going to track this album ourselves, but we want you to mix it, do you have, like, a kind of a summary of, like, these are the things that you should pay attention to, and or notes for the tracking engineer, if there is one?
Yeah, it's a sensitive issue. I mean, if the band track on their own, then I guess it's fine. Then I could come up with whatever instructions needed. If they have that sort of, you know, schedules, so they actually approach me before they start tracking. It's more like, hey, we have recorded this album. Can you mix it tomorrow? And that way I'm happy to assist. And sometimes I even listen to, we're setting a drum sound now. Can you please listen to this? And then I give instructions, please, mm-hmm. you know, use, point the microphones, the overheads a little bit like this. Try to raise the pitch a little bit on the snare, whatever, you know, can help them. And vocal sound is also something that I think is very important and very hard to adjust if it's really bad. So I can help them with, you know, whatever, the microphone choice or placement in the room or stuff like that. And these days, I guess it's pretty easy. You can record with DI for bass and guitars, and that's a big chunk of the sound that could happen in the mix. What was the original question? I forgot.
Oh, just do you have like a standard set of instructions that you send to people, or is it kind of more case by case?
I had a train of thought there, because I said it was a sensitive topic, because it's also, I as a mixing engineer, if there is another producer involved, or another, you know, semi-producer mixing person, mm-hmm. I don't want to take away that person's own perspective by sitting here in Sweden trying to, oh yeah, and you know, do that and that and try sure. to do that, because I'm not there, you know. If I would be there, I would try things. It's not like I have this standard that it has to be exactly like that and that. I always try things. I know sort of what works, of course, but every situation is unique, you know. Well, for this kick drum, this microphone doesn't seem to do it. For this room, we would need to try to do this and this. So I sort of, you know, encourage them to try things and try to do the best of the situation. And I'm happy to listen to things and give them some feedback for that.
All I can say is, if I was the tracking engineer on a project and I knew that you were mixing and you were willing to take the time to give us some feedback or thoughts, I would do my best to at least try to, you know, maybe you wouldn't agree after trying it, but I would do my best to at least try, because you know what you're talking about. I mean, some guys have ego problems to where you don't want to. I've actually seen this happen. That's why I'm saying that, where the mixing engineer contacted the tracking engineer and made a few requests, and the tracking engineer fucking blew up. And these are guys that are, you know, mm-hmm. making real records. We're not talking like amateurs or kids. Mm-hmm. So, it was like, if they had been in person, it would have become a physical confrontation. Mm-hmm. Like, they went nuts over it. And all he was doing was asked for a few things on the drum recording. Yeah. It was crazy. I was shocked by the level of explosiveness. But I guess you kind of need to be careful with who you make suggestions to and when.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, usually it's fine, or at least I don't have to witness the explosion that happens from imposing ideas. But I'm usually happy to say things to those who, you know, give some advice. But I don't want to destroy the creative process by...
Yeah, for sure. So we have some questions here from the audience that I'd like to get to before we have to end this. So here's one from Alex Nasla. Alex, by the way, is the best harpsichord player I've ever heard in my life. If there was an Olympics for harpsichord, he'd be gold medalist for every country. But Alex is wondering, how has your mixing process or mindset changed now compared to when you did the Opeth record, Watershed?
That's a difficult question. I don't know if my mindset has changed so much. My methods have changed, because I used to be on console, and they used to be the band coming in the room, and we finalized the mix and then we went over to the next mix. That doesn't happen anymore, because the industry changed a lot and I had to change with it. So I guess the biggest thing was that at that time I probably mixed from start to end one song and really made it ready, and then I couldn't look back. I think that was the case on Watershed as well, or at least in broad terms. These days, I usually make it like 95% ready, and then I, you know, move on to the next song, and then I go back the next day with fresh ear and, you know, can make some adjustments and whatnot. And the most important thing when mixing is not the tools. It's not the speakers either, or the room, I'm afraid. It is the level of experience the brain has to mix, mm-hmm. you know, to hear things and to hear what needs to be done and that sort of thing. And that I have developed. If I listen back to this Opeth mix, there are some really nice things about it, but there are also some things that I would have considered it to be 90% done, and today I would have completed it, so to speak. Who knows? Perhaps I fuck up and do a much worse mix on the other mix. But that could also be the case because I'm not in the mindset for that album right now. But I guess that
has never happened, by the way, on the other mix. Never.
All right. Okay. So I'll be the first. My brain is more developed these days than it was back then.
Well, it's been 11 years, right?
Yeah.
Has there been any kind of technique changes in the last time, since the last time you were on the podcast? Like, I'm thinking in particular, I remember you mentioned sometimes using Drum-O-Tom to reduce bleed in drum mics, or using a de-esser on the snare track. I know that's one of the areas I've been interested in, is trying to clean up drums better and be more efficient and more less destructive with it, I guess. Has there been any just random techniques that have come up in the last couple years with technology or with anything else?
I just need to say something about using de-esser on the snare drum. It only valids for hardware 902 de-esser from DBX. Do not try a software de-esser on the snare. It will fuck up your face and will not work, unless someone can prove me wrong there. But I have never tried anything that really works there. So be careful. But if you have a 902 de-esser, go for it.
We actually, 2 months ago, I believe, because we did an all analog Nail the Mix, and I believe that the guy used one of those de-essers. Yeah, Paul Levitt used it. I'm 99.9% sure that's what it was and sounded great. So
it does. Unfortunately, it does.
it really does.
If you showed up in a studio without one, do you have any other tricks for reducing cymbal bleed in various drum mics?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't use it anymore because mine were in heavy need of service. I have a bunch and they're all at my service engineer right now and he never fixes things. So I've learned to live without them. But I do use a Drum-O-Tom a little bit. It's a very... You can destroy things with that plugin too, but if you dial it right and only use it where needed, it can be a really lifesaver. There is also one plugin that David Castillo showed me not too long ago called the Wilkinson Debleeder plugin. Have you tried that?
Mm-hmm. I've seen it. I haven't tried it.
It's crazy good.
I haven't tried it, but I've heard of it.
I'm not endorsed.
I know him.
It's so cheap, so I don't have to be. It is actually extremely good. I would advise to try it out. It works more like a gate. But
he's going
to
hear this, and you're going to get everything he ever makes.
Well, I
from now on.
I will definitely check that out.
It is actually crazy good. And they also make one for DSP. So if you're on Pro Tools and do tracking sessions with the AAX DSP system, then you can use it without latency, which has been amazing for me, actually. So, and I usually keep those all the way into the mix. I don't know what kind of life-changing technique there has been otherwise.
We're thinking about the Opeth, as you mentioned before, if you could like change or update one thing about the Watershed mix, or if one thing stood out to you that you would improve like 10%, what stands out to you about that mix? What can we expect in the new improved Heir Apparent?
Or is that something that'll just happen in real time?
Yeah, I guess. I don't know. It was a little trickier with automation back then, so I could probably fine-tune some of those songs on that album with automation a little better these days. It's a little mid-heavier than I would mix these days, I suppose. I probably mix a little brighter these days. You know, old age, less treble. It seems like the whole the industry has gone to a more brighter sound. So, I don't know. I'm happy with that. I would probably have recorded the guitars sound a little different, but I do like how they sound. So,
We have a question here about the guitars, actually, from Anthony Giacomo, which said, The guitar tone on this is outstandingly smooth from the get-go. What kind of process was used to achieve that right off the amp? And are the second set of guitar tracks just a second amp or a second mic on the same cab?
You could try that yourself. If you pan those to the side, you could immediately hear if you get it like a mono center sound or if they spread out and live their own lives, whether it's a secondary track or just a secondary microphone. And actually, I'm only 99% sure that it is two unique performances there. If I remember it correctly, we used... it's actually just when the Marshall JVM amp came out. Mm-hmm. And they were going nuts about that. So that became our main sound. And then we have a Mesa rectifier as the secondary one to complement the first one. I'm going to talk a little bit more about that, I suppose, on the Nail the Mix actual session, how I usually think with building up the guitar sounds. But yeah, it's a process about trying different combinations and choosing whatever seems to work the best. And I don't think there is any real special tricks to that guitar sound. It's just, you know, a lot of pain and time that spent placing the microphones and a combination of microphones and finding the right blend and phase between them and then printed straight, summed straight into the system. It's not recorded different mics on different tracks. I usually try to avoid that.
And a really good guitar player.
Absolutely. Yeah. And guitars.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And fresh strings.
Yeah. That stuff is so important. So here's one from Andrew Tang. In Ghost Reveries and the Great Cold Distance, what gain channel and mode was used on the dual rectifier? Was it boosted or unboosted for rhythm guitar? I'm very curious. Do you even remember? That's kind of detailed.
No, it's a long time ago.
Yeah, I was going to say.
But I'm pretty sure, I mean, it's the red channel. Yeah, that's probably about it. I think it's a two-channel dual rectifier, if I remember it correctly, an old version. But I cannot verify that.
I think last time you mentioned that you were digging the Diesel VH4 as like one of your main kind of go-to amps. Is that changed or is that still kind of your go-to?
I love it. The VH4 and my dual rectifier pre-500 series are amazing amps, in my opinion. I love them. And then I have a Savage 120 that sees some use as well, and a bunch of other amps. But the VH4 and Mesa always seem to come back.
Okay, here's a good question. This one is from Bo Burchell. If you're not familiar with him, he's actually been on Nail the Mix before. He's a great, great mixer. And he was in the band Seosin. And he was wondering, how do you approach mixing records like Ling Tostit Sigur that are in different languages compared to Swedish or English? Do you find not knowing the lyrical content makes it more difficult or eliminates that variable from the emotional equation of the song?
It's a very good question. The thing is, I would say that it's hard to mix on a language that you don't understand. And sometimes that is also the case, like mixing for Japanese bands. Every time I did that, like Deer and Gray, if you know the band, crazy band.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There, I always got like a text file with the lyrics where they had pointed out like the syllables that needed to come up. Because it didn't make sense to me that those were supposed to be pushed. It was nothing about the volume. But the Japanese language is apparently works in a way that it can almost change the meaning, I think. That's how someone explained it to me. If you don't have the right emphasis on certain mm-hmm. things. And so that has been a little weird. But I've mixed for some Finnish bands, for example, where I don't understand a single word, even though Finland is just our neighbors. They have a completely different language tree. So And on those, people always have told me that, oh, we never had this great vocals before, or, you know, we can hear every word. And that's probably because I don't understand it. So that's somehow, since I don't know the lyrics, I seem to place the volume better than someone who hears mm-hmm. the lyrics and has learned it and hear it over and over again. Then it's easy to undermix the vocal level. I would say that it's give and take on that question.
All right, here's one from Benjamin Mueller, which is, love what you did on the 2014 Arch Enemy record. The drum sound is simply mind-blowing. My guess is the use of some artificial reverb IR to enhance the real room tracks. I'd like to know how much room sample were used and how you process it all together to get that massive wall of sustained ringy smack magic to happen. Also, what's your favorite snare for tracking nowadays, and what heads do you usually use? Answer as much or as little of that as you would like.
Yeah. Well, I cannot, you know, remember specifically how I did on that album, but I do usually use a different setup of samples, where I try to gain one sample that, you know, sounds that can add to the snare sound that I'm sort of envisioning, or can add whatever lacks in the real snare. And I usually have a sample that just brings the click, or, you know, the transient, and another one that just gives ring, that doesn't have a transient at all, and another one that brings ambience. And depending on the track, I would use them a little differently, or perhaps not at all. But that's probably the approach I'm using, together with quite a lot of parallel compression, and usually perhaps stacked with a few different parallel compressors that do different things a little bit the same way as I use different samples. That also makes it pretty easy to automate between parts. Let's say if there's a verse with no rhythm guitars, you can easily quickly come down with ambience microphones, if that's what you want, or a ringy sample. You probably want to go down with a little bit, because they get eaten up when they're rhythm guitars. So that's the approach I use for that. I don't remember the second question, but the last question about the heads. I prefer pretty thin heads, even though I had to change them a lot. I prefer Remo Ambassador head. I think that's the best sounding head. Evans is not as good, in my opinion. They have become better. Of course, they come out with new revolutions for their drum heads every year, but still they're only half as good as Remo. Anyway,
I was at a studio that was enforced by Evans, and we just went and bought Remos anyways.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. But now there is actually one drum head that I've been using successfully from Evans lately. That's called the UV1. It's like the finish is different. It's like semi white or something, and that is actually as good as an Ambassador. So but for that album, it's definitely an Ambassador. If it's 2014, I would say. What was the other, there was a question in between there.
What's your favorite snare these days for tracking?
It depends, really.
That's
depends.
A tough one.
Yeah, on the drummer. But I have an old Black Beauty that's fantastic. Nothing like the new Black Beauties. They are black uglies, in my opinion. But the old ones just seem to have something that works.
Yeah, they're great.
Yeah, or whatever supraphonic or super sensitive supraphonic that I can find, aluminium or these Black Beauties are fantastic snares. Sometimes they have a rim that is a little forgiving, which makes them really easy to track with. But for some drummers, it's better with a little higher rim to get a little more of the rim shot. So sometimes I change the actual rim on the Black Beauty to get a little bit more transient, perhaps. But yeah, but I always try everything. I have like 10, 12 snares, and I usually, you know, see what kind of shape they are in for this week. And then I try 5, 6, you know, record, and then we evaluate empirical way of working.
For samples, do you end up usually using samples of the drum that you recorded, or do you have a standard set of samples that you pick from usually? And how many options would you give yourself if you were going to pick, let's say, a snare drum samples for a record? How many would you go through before you pick your final four?
Yeah. Perhaps this relates back to the question, what has changed in my methods? I have too many samples and I try too many. I can spend a full day on nailing a drum sound for an important album just because it's takes a lot of time, you know. Even though I know 99% what it's going to be in the end, I still usually takes the time to actually go through and really see what
confirm.
I can do. Yeah, see what I can find or do differently. But yeah, I have a pretty big selection of standard stuff that I use. I usually do not use things from the actual session. I just never had a really successful time doing so.
Thank you. finally somebody admitted it. Yeah. I don't know. It's never worked for me either. That's why I'm saying that.
Yeah, and I usually think that, you know, I do what the best I can with that, and then I want to, whatever that doesn't have, I want to add with samples.
Right. But it's only going to reinforce what's already there if you use a sample of the actual drum. If you're trying to change the character, then...
In theory, that is a good thing, I suppose. But I don't know. For me, that has never really worked. But I do have some really, really good samples that I have done myself, because I always do a sample session when I record. And some of them over the years, at least two, have been very successful. And
sure.
I end up coming back to them, you know, and bringing them into my mixes. And then I try to pair with other things. Unfortunately, I can end up with between 4 and 8 samples. I know it's horrible, but
I've seen worse.
This is final question. This one's from Dave Crichton, which is, you've worked on a lot of material where you managed to make something that is objectively heavy as balls sound very accessible with almost pop sensibilities. I'm thinking of things like Porcelain Heart off Watershed or the bass-driven bit in Mediocrity Wins by Leprous. Could you talk a bit about how you achieve this and also whether you ever encounter resistance from bands in this area?
How I managed to soften their heavy music? Is that the question here?
I don't know if that's what he means or if he means how you get it to sound so legitimately poppy or something. Really, really good at heavy stuff, and then they go to the clean part, and it's like, God, why did you even do that? What are you thinking? But the clean parts, like Opeth is a great example, or maybe the best stuff they do in some ways. Like it's so maybe he's wondering how you go about achieving that in your productions, getting the cleaner parts to sound just as good as the heavier stuff. And the thing about the bands pushing back is I figure that these bands that you're working with, that's part of their vision, I'm imagining.
Yeah, I suppose. Even if that's the question, or whether making the heavy parts, sound accessible or whatever, I don't know. I have no agenda. I just do what I think sounds good to me, you know. It's sometimes the bands think that, you know, we need the guitars louder, we need to make this heavier, or sometimes the opposite, we want this more keyboard based, or the clean vocals must come up, the grunts must come down. I don't know, it's becomes a mixture of my vision and the band's vision, and it's just me crafting sounds. I guess I don't like when things stand out too much, you know. I've been crazy, especially back in the day, I was crazy about trying to notch away things that stood out. I really try hard not to these days. But let's say that I I listen more to Tori Amos and Porcupine Tree than Carcass, perhaps. Perhaps that's the reason.
That's a good answer. I like that.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is that a band like Opeth isn't, I mean, I wasn't there, but don't they want their soft parts to sound beautiful? Isn't that the deal?
And same with Leprous too. I'm thinking of that the song he mentioned. It's got like kind of a disco beat kind of thing and clean vocals. So it's very it's not what you would expect from a typical metal production.
But in the case of both Leprous and Opeth, it's more about their songs than anything else, I suppose.
Yeah. I mean, those parts didn't end up in those songs by accident.
No. Or perhaps they did. Who knows?
Maybe they did. What an accident. It's a big accident. All right. Well, Jens, thank you so much for coming on the podcast again.
Nice being here.
It's been a pleasure having you. And we will see you on the 28th for Nail the Mix. I'm very, very excited to be coming to your town and ruining your life for 3 days.
Absolutely. I haven't said this before, but I have set up the rig on my boat, so we're gonna be on the water doing the mix.
I'm very excited about that. Joey loves boats, by the way. Great. Joey will be very excited.
Nice one.
All right, man, have a great rest of your night.
To get in touch with the URM podcast, visit urm.com/podcast and subscribe today.